When a person is murdered, but it's not obvious who the killer is, it's often said that the detective or detectives involved have to consider three things. Has anybody watched sufficient TV dramas to know what those three things are? Now expose yourself as someone who has watched. Motive, means, and opportunity. Means, who had the ability to murder? Who had the weapon, the gun in the drawer? Motive, who had the reason to murder? Jealousy, or something else. Opportunity, who had the moment, the access to the victim that they could get to them? Means, motive, and opportunity. And it said, I don't know, I haven't asked the detective. Maybe we should ask Grayson over at Chingford. He was a detective. But it said that the detectives use the criteria to sift likely suspects. Now, Mark 15, Jesus is publicly murdered. That's what happens in the chapter. And we actually know who killed him. Listen to the summary that his friends later gave of the crime. This is Acts chapter 4, verse 27 to 28. Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. So in one sense, there is no detection needed. Herod, Pilate, Gentiles, people of Israel, all involved. But I think actually, in thinking about Mark 15, it's still worth doing some detective work. Because though the means are obvious, nailed to a cross, though the opportunity is obvious, nabbed him in the night and took him just before the festival, the motive's a bit more tricky. Why? Well, because all the people involved don't have the same motive, do they? Pilate is different from the leaders, is different from the people. And then do you remember the end of that little reading from Acts? There was somebody else implicated. Who else was implicated in the death of Christ? God. So, we're going to be detectives, but you don't need to put on a deerstalker or anything. As we go through verses 6 to 15 today with a sermon which will look at four sets of motives for murder. We're going to talk about Pilate's motives, the motives of the leaders of Jerusalem. We don't need to bother with Herod as such because he's not mentioned here in Mark. The crowds, their motives, and God's motives. And try and learn some lessons as we go. Let's talk about, first of all, Pilate's motives. Last week, we were in the Roman governor's court, room, whatever it was they took him into, palace. He's actually probably staying at Herod's palace because he doesn't normally live in the city. And Pilate talked with Jesus. We reminded ourselves of that earlier. Jesus himself didn't do a lot of the talking, but other people were filling up the room with words. He's accused of being a rebel. Thought about that. King of the Jews. Somebody trying to foment trouble in the country. A threat to Roman rule. He claims to be the king of the Jews. Say his enemies in that room. But as we saw, Pilate really not so convinced. He's got this guy in front of him. He's a workman. He's been beaten up. He's bruised. He's bleeding. He looks dazed. He's had a bag over his head. He's been mistreated in all kinds of ways. And Pilate's just not convinced when he sees how Jesus behaves and responds about how big a threat he is. Which leaves Pilate in difficulty. Leaves him unable to make a decision what to do with this man, Jesus. Until, says Mark, an opportunity presents itself. That's verse 6. Now, it was the custom at the feast to release a prisoner whom the people requested. As I say, the governor didn't normally live in Jerusalem. I think he lived in Caesarea, which would make sense given the name of the place. But he does come up to the city for big festivals. Pilate makes sure he's present in Jerusalem when they're gathering for Passover and probably at other times as well. That's because Jerusalem's going to crowd with people, pilgrims coming in, and he wants to be present. And in fact, it says that on previous occasions, what he's done is to sort of show what a gracious governor he is, to show his clemency and to keep the people on side, he performs an act of mercy when he's there. Now you can imagine him doing that to keep the peace. You've got a lot of people, a lot of tension, a lot of national spirit. It's a festival for the nation. And Pilate needs it peaceful. You've got pilgrims there, remember, such as the ones that arrived with Jesus, who have come from the north, and the north is a more troubled area. So Pilate does this act of mercy. He allows the population in Jerusalem, the people, to come to him and to ask for the release of a prisoner. He's going to set free somebody currently charged with a crime. By the way, remember that prison, for them, is not quite like how we think of prison. If I say prison to you, probably your first thought is as a punishment, a place where we send people once they're guilty. Although then you'd say, oh, of course, but it's also used for people before they're found guilty to keep them while we try them. But for them, prison was more that. It was a place you put people to hold them while you were trying them and judging them and then deciding their punishment rather than being the punishment itself. Anyway, that's a minor point on the side. So, Pilate, this occurs to him, this annual thing that he does, or his regular thing that he does. He's going to be offering his mercy. Now, says Mark, there is actually a candidate available for it that presumably Pilate's very aware of. There's somebody being held in the prison that people have got some consciousness of, and the crowd might want him. Judea. Palestine, where they are, is a very troubled country in so many ways. The Romans hold it, but it's not easy to hold it. It causes trouble. Rebels are always pushing the authorities, pushing at the boundaries. And one terrorist gang has recently stirred up trouble and been caught. It's fresh in everybody's memory. Well, their leader is in verse 7. He's a man called Barabbas. As Mark says, who was in prison with the insurrectionists. The people who had had an uprising, who had committed murder in that uprising. I don't know why Mark names him. Why make a point of telling us his name was Barabbas? It might just be that he was very well remembered, and Mark is sort of giving it as evidence. Look, this was real. This really happened in history. I guess it's not impossible that the man later became a Christian, and he was known to Christians who heard the story later. I don't know. We don't have more information about Barabbas. But Mark names him. And Pilate, he has his idea. Verse 8. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. So up come the crowd. I don't know who makes up this crowd, who's around this time of day or whatever, but a crowd comes up anyway. It's before the festival, it's still early, and they come to ask the governor to release a prisoner as usual. Now, Pilate has spies. Of course he does, he's a Roman governor. I mean, goes without saying. He knows Jesus is popular. Jesus has been very visible at the temple. Pilate may not know much about him, but, you know, he did parade into Jerusalem on a donkey. It's not like he's been hiding in a corner somewhere. He knows he's popular, but he also knows that he doesn't see him as a very great threat. So before the crowd call out a name, Pilate presents his preferred option. Shall I release Jesus? Or the way he puts it, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? You wonder how big a shock that would have been, don't you? Did this crowd know that Jesus was being held? Don't know. It might have genuinely been a sort of, whoa, he's got Jesus up there in chains. Jesus was arrested in the night. Who knew he was being held? Other than the Sanhedrin. Okay, the rumours may have spread. You know, you've got the servants and the soldiers out at the fire and things. Maybe people of the word had got out. But you wonder how much of a shock as well there was when Pilate came out. But anyway, Pilate himself, what's he up to? Well, fundamentally, firstly, I think, he just doesn't want to judge Jesus. Now, you find that more clearly in the other Gospels, but even here in Mark, it's fairly obvious. He really does not want to be the man who judges Jesus. This man has unnerved him. As Mark said, Pilate marvelled at him. He was amazed by him. He was just, this didn't fit Pilate's usual way of coping with people. He wasn't sure about this man. So he's trying to palm it off. Let the mob decide the man's fate. It's not my issue. Elsewhere, in another gospel, you know, you've got the famous washing of the hands incident. But we won't go there. That's in another gospel. Secondly, I guess, now this can only be speculative, can't it now? But secondly, it may well be that he's testing the water. Pilate can't see that Jesus is king of the Jews. But if the crowd do choose him and call out for him, well, then Pilate knows to have Jesus watch more closely. So there might be something of that in it, I guess. Thirdly, another motive we know that's definitely in play is the one that Mark tells us about. Pilate asked this, verse 10, knowing it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. Pilate knows he's being pushed around by Jerusalem's leaders, Jewish leaders, and he's not up for that, thank you very much. He's the Roman governor, and he's not interested in other people manipulating him. So we know that he's certainly doing this because he's not going to pander to people who are trying to control him. And of course, you could just say, well, fourthly, I mean, Barabbas is clearly pretty dangerous, so he really doesn't want him back out on the streets. So, you know, if they go with Jesus, then that's all well and good for him. Because Jesus hasn't killed anyone as far as he knows. I think even thinking about that, you know, if you just pause, you read the story and you pause and you think about Pilate just in that way for a few minutes, you realise how much must have been going on in this man's brain at the time. He is managing a very difficult situation, but there's his own reaction as well he's managing, his own response to this king of the Jews stood before him. We understand that whole thought, don't we? There's too much going on in my head to deal with this. Knowing why we act at any moment isn't always simple. Sometimes it may be simple. Sometimes it gets rather complicated, doesn't it, when you think about, why did I do that? Sometimes you just act on things because it's your personality. It's just sort of what you're like. But then there's also pressures that might be on you. Something somebody said to you, something you're feeling at the moment. And then there's anxiety because there's something you're worrying about and that's creating problems in your mind and you're responding to the situation because of the anxiety. Maybe there's a fear of the future, something that could happen if you make this decision. So you decide to make a different decision. There's just physical illness. You're in pain and your reaction is based on the pain you're feeling. There's mental illness. You're in a cloudy fog in your head. Or a great deal of sadness, and you're responding on the basis of your mental state. There's just your time in life. That at one point in your life you'd have reacted this way, but you know, it's not quite the same now you're in middle age, and it's not quite the same now you're in old age, and we are strange people. So you look at Pilate and you sort of think, well, I can understand. He's probably a whole mix of thoughts swirling around in this politician, as he tries not to have to condemn Jesus himself. Sometimes we say of ourselves, don't we? Yeah, it's not easy to explain why I did what I did. I'm not quite sure. It's what drives us to behave in certain ways can be hard to unpick. Maybe having said all of that, though, we should remember this, shouldn't we? It never excuses sin. Sometimes people think it does. that somehow if you can explain what a very complicated character you are, and you are, that somehow that lets you off. But it doesn't, does it? If you do something wrong, it still stays wrong, even if there are all kinds of reasons why you did it. If you did something wrong, you still need forgiveness. Even if you'd say, yeah, but I did it because of things outside of myself that I couldn't control. My motives, yeah, they weren't simple. Well, they may not have been, and sometimes it's helpful to realise that. But if we do something wrong, it's still wrong. We still need forgiveness. And Pilate is going to end up certainly doing something wrong. And it's thanks to a political blunder. He seems to think that his offer to the mob will be accepted. But verse 11 happens. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. Now, you might think to yourself, well, actually, Pilate could live with that, couldn't he? Because what he could do is he could release Barabbas, and he hasn't actually judged Jesus yet, so he could judge him innocent and release Jesus as well and get everything off his hands. But it seems that Pilate can't quite handle what's going on. The chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas to them. Well, what shall I do then with the one you call the King of the Jews? Asked Pilate. Pilate asked them. Notice, by the way, he says, you call King of the Jews. You hear what he's saying? Pilate is saying, but hang on, I don't get this. This guy is popular with you. You regard him as somebody significant. Goodness me, I don't know whether some of you or some other people, but there are a load of you parading into town with him the other day. You call him the King of the Jews. I've had spies. I know some of the good stuff he's done for you lot. You really want to leave him in my hands? The Gentile governor who has people executed? What do you think I'll do to him? I think that Pilate is actually just, he doesn't know how to handle this crowd. And then he gets a response he wasn't realising. Crucify him, they shouted. There's a Jewish crowd asking a Gentile governor to execute a Jewish rabbi. And Pilate's head spins. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. The word crime isn't there. It's just the word evil. What evil has he done to you? But it's too late. Political blunder's been made. Pilate is trapped by his own folly now because the crowd are in chant mode. They're just going over and over it. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him! And now Pilate's got a switch. Now he's the governor in charge of a city that's in danger of rioting. And if it riots, he's going to have to answer to his boss, who's up in Syria, who's going to have to answer to his boss in Rome, and this could go badly wrong. So now he's got a potential riot on his hands. Whatever it is that has made this crowd so angry, whatever it is that's made the crowd suddenly ask a Gentile governor to execute a Jewish rabbi, he's got to pander to it. So verse 15, wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be executed. The flogging is probably a leather whip, multi-stranded, into the whip. It said that they would tie bits of bone, which were sharp. So as the whip hit you, it wasn't just that it would bruise you or cause a little bit of bleeding. It's ripping you open. They are flaying the flesh off his body. And then the death squad take you away. And there is Pilate's ultimate motive for murder. To manage a mob. No principle of justice involved in the end. He just needs to stop trouble that will cause him trouble. It's a horrible picture of that man, but it captures something that's true of human beings. That we will sin, sometimes simply to save ourselves from trouble. It's so tempting to do it. We'll resort to lies or cheating or hurting someone else just to save ourselves from trouble. And there's Pilate. It's wrong. It's always wrong. Pilate murders for an easy life. What about the leaders? Second group and their motives. Leaders are simpler to understand, I suppose. We've seen through Mark's gospel, as we talked about these people that Jesus used to debate with and discuss with, we've seen that they're angry with his criticism because he condemns them. He says, you're corrupt, you've damaged the temple, there's no point in anybody worshipping up here. We might as well throw out all these people changing money and selling animals. There's no point because you lot have turned it into an HQ, a safe house for gangsters to run to. So Jesus' criticism has hurt them and his popularity has offended them because they feel like he's undermining them, their status. He's in their way. And then, of course, when they had him, he said to them, and I'm God's judge and you will be judged. So these guys hate him. And Mark tells us that Pilate sees something of this. He knows they're envious. That they just don't like what Jesus represents because he's in their way. By the way, how does Mark know that? Doesn't say, does he? I would imagine it's because Jesus himself recognised it in Pilate and told the apostles after he was resurrected. It would seem the simplest explanation. But anyway, they are envious and Pilate knows it. And the envy is not surprising. And it's not surprising that envy has this impact. Because actually, envy drives an awful lot of human sin. Again, we think of ourselves. It's nice looking at other people, isn't it? Like a detective story and thinking, aren't they awful? Till you realise that you see yourself in some of these characters. We often treat others badly. We badmouth them. We have cruel thoughts about them because we resent them. Either we want what they've got and we envy in that traditional sense, or we get vicious because they threaten what we have and we don't like the idea of them taking it away. Envy, it's all too common, it's shameful. But that's these men. Educated, wealthy, respected, nasty. However, there is a deeper motive in play too, if we remember earlier in Mark's Gospel. Do you remember chapter 12? Jesus told a story of a vineyard. The vineyard was planted by a man, a farmer, and he got it all going and he installed all the buildings you need and it was up and running and ready to go. And then he moved away. But he rented it out. He rented it out to locals. And what he wanted was some crop from it when it came to fruition. But the farmers who rented it, they weren't so keen on the idea. They wanted to satisfy themselves. They didn't want to pay rent to some remote landlord, despite the fact that he'd set up the whole thing for them and handed it to them on a plate. But even so, they didn't want to pay him something. So when he sent people to collect, they brutalised them. Some of them they even killed, said Jesus in the story. And then the landlord sent his son. Jesus has the landlord saying, as his son is heading off down to the vineyard in the distant land, well, they'll respect him, but they don't. It's almost like the landlord is completely naive. They think, those tenants, that if they kill the son, the landlord will realise they're too strong for him. And he'll give up the vineyard. Jesus says, yeah, like that was going to be the outcome. The landlord actually turns up with a powerful military force, punishes the lot of them and puts new tenants in. What was the parable about? People like the chief priests understood. It was about them. It was about Israel and her leaders. God had blessed them with a nation, blessed the nation with land. He had given it to them on a plate, a land flowing with milk and honey. But they were unwilling to give him love and service. Through history, they killed prophets he'd sent. And now said Jesus, you're going to kill me, aren't you? And I'm his son who's come to you, and you're going to kill me. And that is the priest's deeper motive. They're greedy for power, status, wealth. They desire a life that satisfies them. It's incredibly two-faced. They serve God at the temple with fancy God gear on. And they proclaim his name, talk about him. And they live by his ways to a certain extent. But, says Jesus, there's just no love for him inside. It's all love for self. They hate the absent landlord. And that's the deeper motive of these leaders for killing Jesus. It's rejection of God. It's not how they look on the surface. They look the opposite in a sense. But it's the heart of the matter, says Jesus. That's not unique to them. It's very widespread. You see that? Let's go on to the third group. Let's talk about the crowd's motives. Why do this crowd chant for Jesus' death? Pilate clearly doesn't expect it. Makes no sense to him. He doesn't see why they would suddenly want Jesus dead. Well, again, you can speculate, can't you, in all kinds of things that we've maybe seen in previous chapters. Maybe some of them there just feel let down by Jesus. You know, like Judas Iscariot. I don't know that Judas was here. Maybe he's already gone off and done himself in. But you can imagine others feeling let down. He never was what we wanted. You can imagine others who just resented Jesus' words up at the temple, where he dismissed the temple and said it was corrupt. And maybe some people just got very wound up with him, very upset. Maybe some of them just were angry with him when he discussed taxation. You remember that? A discussion about should we pay Caesar money? Maybe some of them didn't like his answer then. Maybe some just were tired of his constant criticism of their heroes, like the Pharisees. And on top of all of that, you can imagine personal grievance, can't you? He never healed my dying dad in Nazareth. How many times have you heard that from people? The reason they don't believe in God is because he never did what I asked for so and so. Not unusual, is it? We know that Nazareth was pretty nasty with Jesus. Maybe, in a sense, when we look at this crowd, we can almost see that Jesus is being executed by a thousand little cuts. He doesn't actually die because of the flogging, but in a sense, all the little cuts on him that he gets later from the flogging are almost like all the little cuts of hatred from the crowd, isn't it? It might, on top of that, just be that they just see him as useless. You know, he's had his chance to be king, and all that happened is the Roman governors dragged him out here to mock us with him. You call him the king of the Jews, and here I've got him in chains. Well done you, O king. Maybe they just see him as useless. I mean, never underestimate people's willingness to write off others as objects of derision or objects of mockery or objects of hatred, because they're just useless. They don't count for anything. Every day, people dismiss others as nothing. Some of the most vulnerable members of our society, the unborn, the disabled, the very elderly, are just written off. Don't really matter. Useless. But more generally, you know, you get the bitterness towards others that spills out, even for absolutely trivial reasons. Some sort of little road incident turns into rage. As Jesus once said, hatred in the heart is the seed of murder. Once again, we think about those motives, and it says to us, be careful, turn from any sin like this. It so easily grows into something awful. But of course, when you have a group, well, then you get bloodlust. Everybody spurs each other on. The attitude of the group becomes the attitude of the individual, as everyone is swept along, everyone's in the heat of the moment, everyone's got the emotional drive, everyone's got the adrenaline, and no one wants to be different. And then it becomes really dangerous. So on the surface, that's this mob, isn't it? What motivation did they have for murder? But again, it's not enough, is it, to explain the killing of the holy, pure, kind and good man that Jesus is? The deep truth is the one we just saw with the leaders. And Jesus' story foretold. They just hate the landlord. They don't want God. Given the right circumstances, human race, us, yeah, we're capable of terrible things. Human race has done harm that we might find unimaginable to realise people have actually done this. But they do. Why? Depravity. Inside. The race as a whole. Naturally speaking, we have rejected God. We don't want the life he calls for. And so in our pride, we have damaged our hearts and our hearts veer towards evil. It's so important to recognise that is true of us as a people. A race across the planet. Not just other bad people out there. We do that, don't we? We excuse our sin by comparison with others. I am not as bad as so and so. Well, bully for you. Why don't you care about what God thinks? Actually, the reason we don't often care about what God thinks is because we resent his interference, just the way Jesus found. The crowd's motive is the leader's motive. It's hatred for God. So, in our detective work, three motives. And seeing Pilate, seeing the leaders, seeing the crowds helps to hold up a mirror to humanity. Our circumstances are different, but their motives are in all of us. Especially the rebellion against God. And we have to take that seriously. It's the call that Jesus makes upon us. We are made in the image of God, but we have run from the Creator. We can say, but I'm religious. You know, I honour God. I turn up and do my little thing occasionally. Well, these people were way more religious. And we can, or others might say, well, I just can't believe in him because the evidence isn't there. But that's not true. It's just that over millennia, human beings of every sort, religious and so-called irreligious, though the irreligious are typically religious in a different way, human beings, we've trained ourselves to ignore the distant landlord. And Jesus warns us that we need to wake up to the fact that we naturally hate God. And we need something doing about it. Which brings us to the last thing, God's motive. Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. Examining the verses, we've been swimming in the dark pool of wickedness, and in doing so, however, we've tried to remember they're just ordinary, these people, they're like us. But Acts 4 tells us something else is going on too, that God was at work through it all, through the human wickedness, for amazing good. It was the riddle of Jesus' parable. God actually never truly was like the remote landlord, losing a son. He knew the son would get killed. He gave us freedom to do what we wanted so that we would see what we are. But he remained in control all the way through. He knew his son would be killed, but there was a plan in operation behind it all. And if you were sort of shocked by Jesus' parable, then you're the sort of person who would have then gone to Jesus and said, hang on, can you explain this? How does this play out? And you'd have found him telling you, oh, in a very good way. Because it's not the way you thought it is. His plan is so much bigger than proving human nastiness. God plotted to kill Jesus for good reasons of love. It was the motive of love to save us. God sent Jesus to his death. We've heard that many times in Mark's gospel. He did it for our sin. Jesus drank the cup of suffering to free us from the slavery of sin, of God-hatred, Jesus was baptized in the river of our sin. If you want to go right back to the start of Mark's gospel, with its deadly consequences, so he could rise out of the river and save us all from drowning. His suffering and death conquered sin. There was a divine motive in the whole story, in this ugly tale. Pure love is to be found. Father and Son showing the world patience and mercy and grace. That's where our detective story finishes. Ta-da! You suddenly realise all the motives involved, for all the people involved. But actually, the one that really matters is God's motive. That he meant all of this for your good. Jesus is alive. The murder failed. And all shall live forever who trust in him, the Son of God, who died on a cross to save sinners. Focus on that as we finish this tale. Have faith in Christ for forgiveness.